Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Howdy, folks. Thank you for listening to the Flixwise podcast. I'm your host and red lipstick connoisseur, Lady Pelican. And joining me today is a woman who knows how to rock a Western tie. It's Flixwise regular, Anne McCaw Kelly.
Hello.
Anne-Marie is coming at us via Skype. She's a little under the weather today.
Mm-hmm.
But she promised she will be her normal effervescent self, right?
I'm hopped up on enough medication that, yeah, sure, effervescent, we can do that.
Woo! All right. And also here, with guns a-blazin', is today's guest. It's filmmaker, cinephile, and my longtime friend, Madame Caroline the Cockatoo Gollum.
That's the name, friend. Care to change it?
Caroline is here to offer up another submission to the Flixwise favorites list. Listeners are hopefully aware that our show is about watching all the movies on the Sight and Sound Greatest of All Time poll. But in going through that list, we've noticed that while it does feature many of the greatest movies of all time, there are also lots of notable films that were overlooked for some reason. That's why I've put together a Flixwise favorites segment, where one panelist pitches a movie they think should have made the Sight and Sound poll, then the other people on the panel decide if they agree. Today, Caroline's going to tell us why she thinks Nicholas Ray's 1954 Western, Johnny Guitar, is worthy of inclusion in the great movie pantheon. Suddenly all the bird names make sense, doesn't they? Right?
Right.
Yep, perfect sense. Anyway, Caroline, tell me something nice.
Well, Johnny Guitar is about a lot of things, but I guess at its foundation it's about a woman of ill repute with a checkered past named Vienna who runs an eponymous saloon that happens to be on a parcel of land that will be bought by the railroad. And when the railroad comes to town, that means that there's going to be a lot of new people coming in and a lot of development. And normally this would be a good thing, but Vienna is under siege by a group of townies, ranchers, and money grubbers led by, I believe, Emma Small, played by Mercedes McCambridge. So it's about two women squaring off against each other instead of engaging in sisterhood and solidarity. Mm-hmm. And Johnny Guitar, of course, refers to her ex-flame, played by a very strapping Sterling Hayden, who comes to town at her behest to provide music for the saloon, but then gets mixed up in all this mishigas.
Okay, well, I think that's a pretty good summation. It's a pretty good introduction. Now, why do you think it deserves entry into the Flixwise favorites list?
Oh, where do I even begin? Mm. First of all, it's part of a rare subgenre of the Western canon that features a woman as the lead. There are a couple of other films that do this really well. The only one that comes to mind for me right now is 40 Guns, the Sam Fuller movie, which is a blast if you haven't seen it. But Johnny Guitar is also very unique in that it deals with like probably about eight different kind of social issues at once. There's the obvious metaphor for communism and the witch hunt and the way that this town gangs up on Joan Crawford and casts aspersions on her. But then there's also an interesting way of looking at gender roles, too, in the movie. Mercedes McCambridge is the head of this gang of people, and they all take orders from this woman. And Vienna is the head of her kind of coterie over at the saloon, and they take orders from her. And the elder Carradine in the beginning of the movie actually at one point says to Sterling Hayden, "I never thought I'd be working for a woman and liking it, too." So everybody seems to be pretty stoked on having ladies in charge in the context of this movie.
Absolutely.
And even the role between Vienna and Johnny Guitar is very interesting too, because he comes to town, he doesn't have a gun. The gun, of course, being the great phallic symbol that ties all these Westerns together. You know, she's wearing pants. He's a singer with a funky name. You know, she's in charge and he's not. And so it's, I think, very progressive for 1954. It's also a Western that, you know, if you believe that Westerns are the way that we tell our history to future generations through film, or even just make sense of it currently using the framework of the Western, I think that that movie is one of the first kind of postmodern, like, nouveau Westerns that was completely self-aware. It's not like Flaming Star, where you're watching this movie going, oh, it's so gay and Elvis is in it, whatever. Like, it's a movie that was very consciously using the tropes of the Western genre to speak about a lot of very hot-button issues of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's in, was it VistaVision? or Technoscope, one of those things. It's a really pretty movie.
It is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Let's not discount that. All right, Amory. I feel like every time we hang out, this movie gets brought up. And when Caroline suggested that we talk about this movie, I knew there was only one person that I needed on this panel, and that was you. Not to give anything away, but how do you feel about Johnny Guitar?
Oh, I don't know. When people ask me what my favorite Western is, which is a question that comes up surprisingly often, it ends up, I always do the thing that you're supposed to do, and I may name a John Ford Western, or I usually say The Searchers, but if I was being really and truly honest, and really being true to myself as a film nut and as a Western lover since, like, way back, my choice would actually be Johnny Guitar. This movie is bizarre and campy and like we were saying before, an inversion of pretty much every Western trope out there, and it does it so with such a devil may care intelligence about it. Even it manages to both be smart and fun and funny. And I also am always way, way in favor of any Technicolor Western that involves a great deal of ambient gay, and boy does this one have that in spades.
when we first brought up the idea of talking about Johnny Guitar, or when I pitched it to you guys, when I like gave us the outline, Anne-Marie promised a ridiculously gay analysis interpretation of this movie, so we can all look forward to that.
I mean, it's not subtle. It's pretty much in your face gay.
Okay.
Wait a second, though.
Okay.
Hold on.
Hold the phone. Yes, the movie is, like, super campy. And looking at it from 2015 or even, like, 1999 when The Celluloid Closet came out and, like, kind of blew the lid off how gay this movie is, do you think that people who saw this movie in 1954, do you think they watched it and they were like, oh, you know what? This is a great movie, but man, is it gay. Or do you think that that's something that we have kind of added retroactively, you know, looking back on it from years of enlightenment and, you know, post-Stonewall, blah, blah, blah?
The issue of where this is going to get much more complicated much more quickly than I intended it to, because the issue of female sexuality on screen, generally speaking, is such a tricky issue, especially when you hit movies from the 1950s, that I think it's there. I think it's there not subtly. I think certain groups, let's say, would pick up on it. But just like any good subtext in a movie, and it is subtext, it's never text, you can watch it without reading it. It's there. It's there for anybody who wants to see it. And I think it was there even in 1954. But it's like when I rewatched Calamity Jane recently and had a conversation with somebody where they're like, oh, no, it's totally straight. I'm like, yeah, it is. But it's also the story of how they straightened out a pants wearing, gun loving, girl loving chick. So it's the tricky question of subtext, and especially the tricky question of subtext in sex-scared 1950s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's probably more of like a secret message. You know, I think if you were a housewife or a regular guy seeing that movie on a Friday night in 1954, you'd come away from it and go, hey, a Western with a lady. Well, that's pretty neat. But if you were gay, or if you were, a liberated woman, or Western tie enthusiast seeing this movie in the 50s, you probably would have picked up on that dog whistle.
Western tie enthusiast, is that a euphemism?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. And I think...
you know what it's a euphemism for.
I think part of that also has to do with just the roles that Joan Crawford and Mercedes McCambridge play within the movies. I mean, I'm not going to deny that Mercedes McCambridge doesn't have just kind of a general ambient gay about her that just kind of exists in a fair number of her movies, not the least of which being Touch of Evil, where I'm not actually even sure what gender her character is. But the fact that having them placed against each other theoretically with a male love interest in the middle, he's basically their male gay away. Like, no, it's totally straight. They're both arguing over him. And they even have that comment of how Emma Small doesn't like him because he makes her feel like a woman, which... yeah, but she spends all of her energy and her focus on Joan Crawford. But that's part of just how their roles in the story are. I mean, there's a lot of homoerotic subtext in a lot of Westerns, not just between the two cowboys out alone at night, but also between right. the protagonist and the antagonist. That's just kind of when you have two characters spending that much time, energy, thought, emotion on each other, that kind of subtext just builds. So it's, absolutely. I think it's a product of them playing the roles that they do.
Yeah. I mean, is there anything in the film that, anything in the composition or the way it's shot that suggests that Emma is in love with Vienna? Like, where are we getting this idea?
I mean, I think it's pretty apparent too. And, you know, and this is, I mean, I'm not really taking like an academic stance on this movie, but even looking at that movie, like, you can tell, man. There's like one scene in particular when she burns down Vienna's saloon.
That's the one I was going to say. That's the one I was going to say. Yep.
Oh, yeah. You know, that scene where she you see her from behind. She's watching the saloon burn. I mean, first of all, she shoots down the chandelier with a shotgun, which is super camp.
Oh, God, yeah.
Super lazy. But then she flees. And she, yes, it is. And then she watches the saloon burn. And then she turns to the camera and she's got this like ecstatic look on her face. She looks more aroused and more engaged in that shot, that close up, than she does at any point when she's in the same room with the dancing kid. I mean, there's that scene where Johnny Guitar starts playing at the beginning of the movie and he takes her for a spin around the dance floor and you think, oh, this is it. She's going to lose her mind because she's obsessed with him. And she really just looks kind of inconvenienced and grossed
agreed.
Out. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just my projecting this onto her, but she definitely seems more excited and more flushed with Vienna in the room.
Yeah, I really don't think you're projecting. Like, the most emotion or the most joy that you get out of her character in that entire movie is when she's burning down the saloon. And girl looks like she just sat on a washer dryer for a bit. Like, she looks very happy with herself.
Yeah.
Nice.
You gotta get your kicks where you can in this life.
So I think it's there. Yeah, that's right. And it is to a certain degree. I mean, if you do want to get a little bit more in depth or Freudian about the characters, which plenty of academics have done, you have this character, you have this story, if you were taking it from Emma Small's perspective of trying to kill the thing that she's not supposed to love that she does love, which is also a terrible, terrible trope that exists in the terms of like the lesbian bad guy, where the lesbian bad guy is in love with the protagonist who probably isn't aware. This is also the gay bad guy in general, talking here about Ben-Hur. In love with the protagonist. Protagonist doesn't know it, and so must destroy the protagonist in order to stamp out the evil feelings inside.
I mean, that the trope of the repressed, buttoned-up, puritanical woman is so common and can be kind of tiresome. I mean, it's awesome when it's used effectively, like Rebecca is the most is the thing that's coming to mind at the moment, but why does it work in this film? Why do we take such joy in watching her obvious pain?
I think that it's a testament to how well written this character is as a villain that we still enjoy it, because, you know, like I said, we're watching this movie in 2015 and we're able to recognize this lesbian subtext and this kind of frustration and this washing away of the gay experience. But Mercedes McCambridge's character in this movie is pure evil. She's a terrible person. And I think this also speaks to the political power of the film too, that, you know, yes, you do feel bad for her, but what little sympathy you have for her is very quickly spent by the end of what, like act two, when stuff starts to get really real, you know? And I think it's just, it's interesting because, you know, as much as I don't like the gay bad guy trope in movies and I'm getting kind of sick of it, I feel like you can almost kind of excuse it in this movie because she's just such an amazing villain.
Mm-hmm. And she is so well-rounded. I don't know that I always kind of feel sympathy for her. I feel like she's too pathetic to feel anything but pity for her. And I think that speaks to how well she's written and how well Mercedes McCambridge performs that role, because while she is a disgusting, evil human being, it never devolves totally into caricature, I think. You might dispute that. But, yeah, and I mean, she literally has a black hat on at one point. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very clearly.
Yeah.
She's the bad very guy. Evil. I would also kind of dispute. Well, I'll let you answer to that. Like, would you agree that she's well rounded?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And she's well rounded, but having the sympathy for her, it's a credit to the film. But at the same time, like, for a movie like this, and I kind of feel this way about many Westerns, like, it's very easy to just take a very black and white idea of, like, this woman's the bad guy and Joan Crawford's the good guy. So you can watch this movie many times, and then depending on what mood you're in on the day, like, you can watch it and feel terrible for Emma Smaller. Then you can watch it and go, you know what? No, screw her. Like, she's a terrible person. Mm-hmm. And part of me really enjoys watching her as a terrible person continue to suffer and then watch Joan Crawford maintain this awesome composure in her fabulous pants.
It's true.
Yeah, Joan Crawford has what? Three costume changes by the in the third act alone. Like, oh, I'm about to get hanged. Gotta put on a new outfit. Like, what?
This movie knew how to spend its budget well. It had a limited budget, but what it had, it seemed to have put almost exclusively into the costumes, mm-hmm. which I think was wise.
Yeah. And that set, too, which I really like.
That is a great, I love her saloon. Vienna's.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I want to mention one quick thing about this, actually, and you notice it the most when she's, like, at that piano, obviously, but in the beginning of the movie, you know, the whole first, like, hour of that movie just takes place in the saloon, and the whole point of it is these people come into her space, they're trying to tell her she's an outsider, you know, they're trying to get rid of her, but the place that she occupies is literally built into the side of a mountain. Yeah. Like, the whole back part of that saloon is, like, the inside of a cave.
Right, yeah. Do you think it speaks to the permanence of the place? Like, this is from the earth. You're not getting rid of me.
Yeah, of
course. You're gonna have to blow me out of this side of this mountain.
I mean, they try to, but I always get the feeling by the end of this movie that, you know, they just sort of pick it up and she's like, well, whatever, I'll just build it again with that fat railroad money.
Mm-hmm. So, but we talked about how this movie, some have called this movie campy. And I kind of want to dispute that. Not because, well, I guess we should need to clarify what we mean by campy.
I think we all are going to have a different definition.
Okay. Okay. I mean, so camp, in my understanding, camp is kind of popularly defined. What, the first person to attempt to define camp was Susan Sontag.
North Hollywood High School alumni, by the way.
By
everybody
the way,
do a shot. We just said Susan Sontag. Everybody do a shot.
Is that the rule? Done.
Yep. Anytime you reference notes on camp, you got to do a shot.
Oh, good to know.
But a shot of, like, pink flavored tequila.
Perfect. I happen to have some of that on hand. So she defined camp in her essay, Notes on Camp. And she said it was a sensibility that, among other things, converts the serious into the frivolous. Now, I don't know if that's fair, and I don't know that that's necessarily the fairest quote to pull from that very, very long, detailed essay, but I think this movie, I take this movie very seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually, for me at least, I think the definition of camp in this context is the inverse, that you're taking the frivolous and converting it into the serious. I mean, look at the surface of this movie. Everything about it is patently ridiculous. Mm-hmm. From the gowns to the title to, you know, Sterling Hayden's, like, one-dimensional archetypal man with a guitar character, and even the dialogue and, like, how hysterical people get. But the film has real depth. The characters are, like you said, very well-rounded, and it has so much meaning. Mm-hmm. And you could argue this, too, about, like, numerous other campy movies that if you really wanted to examine them seriously and look at them critically as works of art, then you could pick something as frivolous as, say, Rocky Horror and look at, you know, the real social and political implications.
I don't feel comfortable lumping this movie in with Rocky
no,
Horror.
No, I pulled Rocky
other,
Horror out of my butt because I was thinking, well,
no,
better,
but that is the when you think of camp classic, you think of Rocky Horror.
No, or like a Douglas Sirk movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I recently watched Imitation of Life while recovering from a lady's procedure, and I felt it was fitting. And, you know, the movie, I'd never seen it before. And John Waters cites it as one of his favorites. It's a huge campy movie.
It's on the Sight and Sound list.
It's on the Sight and Sound list. You know, Imitation of Life is a super campy movie, but it deals with, you know, racial equality, with women's equality, mm-hmm. with identity, and, you know, heavy stuff.
Right. I think, again, that's another example of a movie where it often gets lumped in with camp classics, but I feel like that's a way to dismiss the melodrama genre as a whole. Like, I feel like just because it's about feelings doesn't, and it's got big, pretty colors, doesn't necessarily make it camp. And I don't know if we're prepared to dissect exactly what camp is, because it is sort of, the definition is amorphous and you kind of know it when you see it. But I don't know, I'm still a little hesitant to like call it camp.
I call it camp, but yeah. I also don't think of calling it camp as a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because I am all for saying John Waters is an auteur, and partially because, I don't know, I guess I grew up on it. But
absolutely.
The way that I tend to think of it is that camp is, what's that? Okay, so Susan Sontag, do a shot. Susan Sontag did her presentation, but then another gentleman named Mark Booth had his own, and I'm paraphrasing, but I think what he said was, to be camp is to be present oneself as committed to the marginal with a commitment greater than the marginal merits. But to me, that also means not only the marginal, but the marginalized. So the reason why camp ends up being so, I don't know, political, why people either are so quick to dismiss it or so quick to say, no, 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 don't, is because it won't just be about, you know, big flashy colors or, you know, the aesthetic things that we're talking about, but often it'll be used by groups or used by people who are marginalized or feel themselves marginalized. So in the case of Douglas Sirk, it'll be about, you know, racial issues. In the case of Johnny Guitar, it'll be about women taking men's roles and a not so subtle subtext of lesbianism, et cetera, things like that. And that's why I don't think we should dismiss it. If we give it the label of camp, I don't think we should dismiss it because of that label.
Right. And I don't mean to dismiss camp as a whole. Like, I think camp is fantastic. I love John Waters movies, but I just question whether this movie qualifies. Can we, like, maybe cite certain examples of things that we think are really campy in this movie?
Playing the piano in a white ball gown?
Yes.
Yes.
In front of a rock face.
The three costume changes in the third act.
Okay.
But also the scene that we referenced earlier of Mercedes McCambridge burning the place down.
Oh. Yes. Yes.
The money shot.
Yes.
Turkey is camp, too.
Turkey is camp. Oh, by the way, yeah, I guess I should explain why I gave everybody bird names in the beginning. That had to do with the character named Turkey.
Poor Turkey.
Poor Turkey.
Poor Turkey. The doomed youngin that appears in every Western.
Yes. Gotta have it. And this one is called Turkey. And that alone, I think you're right, that name alone qualifies this as camp.
But even his whole thing, like his relationship to Vienna as like this object of lust who's also a mother figure. Oh, and also their hideaway is behind a waterfall. Come on, guys. It's beautiful. They have to go through this like waterfall paradise to get to their boy cottage.
There's really nothing more to say about the waterfall. It's there. It's fantastic.
I know.
Yeah. Do we have anything else to say about Turkey besides the way Joan Crawford says the name Turkey is magnificent?
She says it like it's a real name for somebody. It's beautiful.
Never doubt Joan Crawford's commitment.
It's true.
Because she can say things with a straight face. She can call a man Turkey with a straight face.
It's true.
The gunfight, or the one-sided gunfight between Johnny Guitar and Turkey when he comes in and starts shooting at the place, and it's the first time you see Johnny with a gun, because he makes a whole point of, I don't carry a gun, you know, I'm not a gunman, I have a guitar instead. And then again, you know, I'm not like, I don't need a gun to show how man I am, but he really does need the gun to step up and put little Turkey in his place.
Right.
And that exchange is amazing. It's like this little boy wants to be a man. He wants to show off for Vienna, stick around and protect her. She kind of chides him like a child. And then he just starts going off with this, you know, gun penis. And Sterling Hayden's got to get his bigger gun penis and put him straight.
It's true. And yet, despite all the penis stuff,
you know,
all the penis metaphors, this movie is, I would say, among the most feminist films of the 1950s, which I would also say is a decade where we got a surprisingly feminist decade for film.
No doubt.
If not actual real life. But let's, maybe we can pinpoint what makes this film feminist besides it having both a female protagonist and a female antagonist.
Okay, well, first of all, Vienna's monologue when Johnny Guitar shows up and he's like, oh, you know, how many men were there after I left you in the saloon and how did you get here? And she says, you know what, I'm not proud of how I got here, but a man can do anything as long as he still has his pride. And all a woman has to do is slip once. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that at some movie theater in 1954, a bunch of housewives heard that line and started losing their minds. Like, maybe on the inside. Mm-hmm. But the first time I saw that movie, I heard that one, and I could not believe this was in a movie from 1954.
I know,
I'm so impressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything about the film reads to me as feminist or female empowering. Like the way that we are introduced to Vienna as a character, she's shot, it's a low angle shot, it's her purveying her bar, her casino, her saloon, and the following shot is a POV of her looking down on Johnny Guitar. Like, she's clearly the most powerful figure in the entire movie, from top to bottom. And that is such a rarity. Like, there's a lot of talk about the female gaze. And, like, 1950s, the era of Hitchcock. And here we have this movie where the woman is looking down on the man.
Mm-hmm.
And what a man indeed. I think that Sterling Hayden is objectified in that movie, like, very frequently, not just in the shot that you're talking about, but in numerous instances. And that's another huge part of what makes this movie so rad, is that if you like a big, tall, hot dude, there is something for you here.
There are two of them.
Yeah, the other guy's okay.
Yeah.
I like that Carradine.
Yeah.
He's really chill.
Johnny Carradine?
Yeah. He's like the dude of
he
that bar.
He is the dude. He's the... Oh, but I did want to mention... I will get to comparing this and other Westerns in a second, but if the only way this movie could be better is if that John Carradine character were played by Walter Brennan. Because that seems to me to be Walter Brennan's part, and John Carradine totally stole it from him.
Walter Brennan was making another Western, and so they couldn't get him. This movie does not have Walter Brennan, so it is a 99 out of 100 possible Western points. But Carradine is so cool, and he seems like he's acting from another era. Like, this movie, and this is true of a lot of movies from this era, you get this weird variety of performance styles. Like, Joan Crawford started in The Silence and made her way through, you know, the pre-code era and all this stuff, and now she's, like, acting 1954. Sterling Hayden comes to acting after the war. The older guys in there, who knows what they were doing. Mercedes McCambridge is coming from radio. Mm-hmm. But they all dovetail really nicely. And Carradine especially seems like he could be in, I don't know, like some movie from the 70s. And maybe I'm saying that because his kids are all in those movies, but he just seems like super chill and like really low key. Just
blends
like
in
a
with
cool
the furniture.
Guy. Yeah, he's just a whatever dude who's ready to hang out, and then he gets it at the end.
Oh, poor Sam.
Yeah, poor Sam.
Okay, so let's compare this to other Westerns. There are Westerns on the list. It's one of the few genre films that is represented on
the list. It's because the French like them.
So we have, I think I wrote down a couple of them that I noticed on the list. Here we go. Okay, so The Searchers is in the top 10. We've talked about The Searchers. Apparently Caroline's a big fan. Rio Bravo made the top 100.
Rio Bravo should replace The Searchers in the top 10.
I politely disagree.
It's like that.
But I do think
we'll have an opportunity to talk about it.
I do think you could make a correlation between, or a connection between Rio Bravo and Johnny Guitar.
I think we should.
Well, I think Rio Bravo sets up a lot of those archetypes that Johnny Guitar is playing with, especially because Rio Bravo's got the, it's got the subtext in spades, but it's got the young kid that everybody feels paternalistic towards. It's got, you know, the guy with a checkered past who's, you know, trying to come back and save it. Pretty much the only, it doesn't sync up in terms of plot points, I would say, but in terms of establishing what each archetypical character is and what their place in the story is, it syncs up very nicely.
Let me Let me see if this adds up to you guys. I thought of There Will Be Blood when I watched the movie.
That's not, I don't think that's too far from
yeah.
from the norm. I mean, it's about progress.
Right,
like, there
right.
is a political component to this movie that does kind of dovetail a little bit with, like, the development narrative of
right.
There Will Be Blood.
So in There Will Be Blood, we have the Daniel Day-Lewis character who is a prospector, right? Facing mm-hmm. off against the puritanical, dogmatic preacher man. And I think that there's an obvious parallel between that and Johnny Guitar, where we have Joan Crawford as the enterprising young, or not young, but enterprising, forward-thinking businesswoman versus the, what would you call it?
Ranchers.
Like the moral crusader, kind of, you yeah. know, like this is progress is wrong. We fear you. And we're afraid of change. We want things to stay the way they are. Not to mention the homoerotic subtext, which one could argue that that is there in There Will Be Blood as well.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, what's interesting though, is that in There Will Be Blood, like the moral square off in that movie is between a free market capitalist who's a self-made man who believes in progress and is basically out for number one. He says it like multiple times throughout the movie. He's out for number one. And he's squaring off against this religious guy, and it's like, okay, what's going to have more sway over this community, Christ or money? Conversely, in Johnny Guitar, I feel like Vienna's mission is a little bit less like, I'm a businesswoman, and this is my property, and every man for himself. There is some of that in the way she talks about wanting to stay with the land, but she does have this thing, you know, when she's confronting the angry mob about how, you know, the railroad's going to bring all these people, and you can't keep them all out. And even the way Emma Small talks about hundreds of thousands of people are going to come from the East. And you know she's just talking about the Irish and the Jews and how they don't want them in their town. And so there's a fear of progress that I think for the townspeople in Johnny Guitar is more about making sure that the land belongs to the right kind of people, their kind of people. And Vienna is not the right kind of people. She represents that new breed, right? The city kind of person, the more cosmopolitan person. She wears pants. Mm-hmm. She used to be a woman of ill repute, and she mm-hmm. wants the railroad to come in, partially for the money, but also because she wants the town to expand.
Right. And it's shown how she's very fair to the people that she works with. The point is made. She's a very fair businesswoman, not simply out for herself.
Mm-hmm.
I love that, too.
Yeah.
I love that she gives him, you know, equal shares and everything. And the man that she talks to from the railroad, she wants to partner up with him. She's way more, shall we say, collaborative than Daniel Plainview is.
Right, right, yeah. I think it's an interesting comparison, but Daniel Plainview is sort of a darker, much darker figure.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is sort of an obligatory topic, but let's talk about the film as an allegory about the House of American Activities. It seems like every Western made in the 1950s is inevitably just an allegory about how screenwriters were persecuted by McCarthyism.
Well, they had to get it out some way.
I guess so, yeah. But do you think... It seems like the allegory is very clearly there.
Oh, yeah. I think this one's more overt than some of the other ones are necessarily.
I think it's cool. I think it's gutsy, and I think it's very fitting to
I know. This was considered
about.
A bomb at the time. No one knew what to make of it. Mm. And I could see why.
Yeah.
It's like it's part Western, but part melodrama.
It's a woman's picture, too.
It's a woman's picture.
I do,
but
like
at the same
pictures.
Time, I'm sort yeah. I kind of would like to divorce all of these movies from that whole the whole storyline about the HUAC, only
you
because
though.
You can't. But it works well just as a story about outsiders. And Nicholas Ray made movies about outsiders. It's as true here as it is in Rebel Without a Cause or In a Lonely Place. Like it's people who don't fit into society. And I think that message is as powerful now as it was in 1950. So while the historical context is important, I don't think it necessarily defines the movie in any way. And I think that in some ways, for me, constantly bringing up The Blacklist makes the movie, like, sort of ties that movie to that time period. Whereas if we just think of it as a movie about feeling ostracized or just coming up against, you know, society that pushes, like, the society where you feel you don't belong, I feel that's a more timeless message, universal message.
It is. I think that the House and American Activities Committee is just kind of one instance in a long history of people who feel that they live against the grain or outside the lines of what society expects of them. Not to say that communists are, like, sterlingly great people, right. obviously. Right. But, you know, in this instance, like, the Communist Party in the United States at that time included people who were working in the movie industry. And what are we talking about? We're talking about homosexuals, liberated women,
Jews.
Some ethnic minorities.
Yeah,
of course. So what we're looking at is people who are living outside, you know, polite WASP society, or as I like to call it, real America. And they're living on the coasts. They're living fabulous lives. They make dreams for a living, you know. They chill on the back lot and go to Sardi's or whatever. And, you know, people in Washington don't like that kind of thing. And they don't like the influence that these people were beginning to exert over the American public after they came back from the war.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I feel like we got most of my talking points in. Mm-hmm. Should we put this to a vote? Any final thoughts before we put it to a vote?
Yes, what are we voting on?
Whether or not this movie makes it into the FlixWise favorites list. I know you're all on the edge of your seats. Yeah, will it make it? What will they say?
I'm going to be really surprised if it comes out.
Yeah, why wouldn't it? We all just spent 30 minutes talking about how great this movie is.
I know. Yeah.
But any final thoughts? Let's wrap it up.
I love the song by Peggy Lee that accompanies this movie. Mm-hmm. And I also really, truly believe that sometimes all man needs in this life is a cup of coffee and a cigar.
Lady P, what are your final
thoughts? Pearls of wisdom.
What are your final thoughts?
Well, I just kind of, one thing we didn't touch on is the roulette wheel and how loves to spin the roulette wheel. And I love everything that the roulette wheel represents. I love everything that the chandelier represents. I love that Emma knows to shoot down that chandelier. Because that's how you get to her. That's like the symbol of civilization, the roulette wheel. It's like what she's building. And soon the whole place will be filled with chandeliers and roulette wheels. And the roulette wheel is red and black. And I love how Emma is dressed in black. And Joan Crawford is constantly either wearing red on her outfits or on her lips. And I love that visual motif. I think that's brilliant. And just basically everything that we've touched on in the film, it feels like such a singular work. You don't see very many Westerns that feature women in these roles. They're so rare. And because of that, I do feel like this movie absolutely deserves entry into the FlixWise favorites list. But Anne-Marie, any final thoughts?
I think that Joan Crawford's 50s career is often cast aside or people cast aspersions on it because so much of her so much of her more glamorous, more conventionally sexy and less complicatedly angry films happen in the 30s and 40s. But I think that Johnny Guitar, which is probably the best movie that she made in the 50s, is a great example of just her sheer staying power. Because she controls this movie and she dominates this movie. And she is a large reason, not only for why the movie was made, but for why it feels and looks and plays the way that it does. And we haven't really talked about it as a star vehicle, but I think it absolutely works as a star vehicle and just shows how powerfully she could manipulate her own image and her own charisma.
Yeah, right. You're absolutely right. We have not talked enough about Joni on this show, which is a serious oversight. I'm so glad you brought that up.
So that's all I got. Coming and I'm saying this as a person who is not actually a huge Joan Crawford fan in general, but you cannot deny in general.
Are you team
not
Betty Davis?
Specific.
Well, I'm team Betty, but I love them both.
I love
Why
them
do we
both.
Have to choose?
I know.
I don't feel like making them compete. They did that enough when they were actually alive.
Yes.
But I think this is a movie that shows you how powerful her just star power is. Like it's a real thing. It's a real skill. God knows how she wields it, but she does.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. Word.
And this is probably also a very risky role for an actress to take at the time, right? Like, I don't know if they approached other women about it or
no,
what.
No, it was Joan's project.
Yeah, it was her baby.
Oh, it was her project?
Yeah, she,
you know what? Good for you, sister.
She sold it to Republic Pictures on saying, you're going to make this movie and I'm going to star in it and here's who I want in it. And yeah. Not all of it turned out the way that she wanted it to, but a good chunk of it still did.
Yeah. Yeah. Joan Crawford, auteur.
All right. Well, on that note, let's put it to a vote. Anne-Marie, what say you?
I am in favor.
All right. I am too. Caroline, I assume you haven't changed your mind in the last 40 minutes?
No, I love this movie even more now than I did when we started.
Perfect. All right. I hereby induct Johnny Guitar into the FlixWise favorites list.
Ooh. In your face, Sight and Sound.
Yeah, seriously, Sight and Sound. Get your stuff together.
And that's the way we frame it. FlixWise, that is. All right, people, you've got 24 hours to rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Otherwise, we run you out of town. Don't like it? You can come find us on our website, FlixWise.com. Or you can find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. Or if you want to take it up direct with me, I'll be holed up on Twitter. The handle is at FlixWise. Seriously, please give us a good rating. We'd really appreciate it. Hey, you know who's a big fan of Johnny Guitar?
Who?
Martin Scorsese! He even does a little intro on the DVD extras for the film. We'll see if we can spot a little Nicholas Ray influence on our next Sight and Sound entry, Taxi Driver.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Until then, Caroline, thank you for bringing Johnny Guitar to our attention.
Thank you for having me.
Anne-Marie, thanks for riding with me.
Always a pleasure.
And we're off to find a cigarette and a good cup of coffee. Until next time, keep that wheel spinning.
Maybe you're cold, but you're so warm inside. I was always a fool for my Johnny. Johnny Guitar.